So I'm wondering, is there anybody here today for whom this is your first time coming to Spirit Rock? Welcome. Would you like to tell us your name?
Sure, yeah, my name is Jared.
Jared, great. Where's...
I'm from Petaluma today.
Oh, great, not far.
Yeah, not too bad.
Did you come the back way?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. What inspired you to come today?
I think maybe the transfer, and then finding you guys online.
There's a lot to salivate over the website, isn't there? There's a lot that's there.
Yeah.
Well, great, Jared. I'm glad you're here. Thank you. You're welcome. Anybody else? Yes. Wow.
And I'm visiting Marty
Lake. Oh, great. Oh, very nice. Welcome. Welcome, Marty's family. So nice that you're here. Thank you for coming. Hi.
Hi.
I was just saying hi to Marty's mom.
Jean.
Jean, hi, I'm Heidi. Welcome. Thank you for coming. You're welcome. And yes. Yes.
Hi. My name is Paula.
Paula, welcome.
I live in Los Angeles. I'm on my way to
Blue Lake. You are?
And I stopped here.
Blue Lake, not like near me? Arcata? Wow. Why are you going to Blue Lake?
Doing a workshop at the...
Oh, cool. Great. There's a fantastic theater school in Blue Lake, which is a tiny little town that is due east of Arcata, Eureka, that has world-class theater. You're going to take... Is it physical? Physical theater?
I hope not.
That's great. It's a very special place. Have you been there before?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Good. You know, oftentimes when I'm here, there aren't many people who know the area where I'm from, so it always feels a little, it's nice, a little kindred. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anybody else for whom this is your first time at Spirit Rock? Yeah? Well, welcome to Wednesday morning class. What's your name? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Willow, welcome. Where's home? Oh, great. So, boom, right over the hill. Good. Yeah, isn't it a beautiful, this beautiful center, beautiful hall? We're lucky to have this. That's great. Summer solstice. Doesn't this feel good? This wide open time. It feels like such an amazing time of possibility when the light starts at 5 a.m. and goes to 9:30. I love it. I don't know. It's just wide open and it's just a little more spacious. I want to begin, before we have our meditation this morning, I want to begin with a poem. And there are copies of these poems. I love to use poems in my teaching. I think there's so much in it, and I'm not the only one who does that. I know that we hear poetry a lot in Dharma talks, but there's a reason for that, because it evokes something in us that is really... intimate. I think it's an intimate experience. So on the back table, if Lyle's got some, if anybody wants them, they're just for you. You don't have to follow along, but they're just for you to have. And I do want to say that you might be wondering why there are laundry bags on the back table. Also, my other job besides teaching is that I own a laundromat in Arcata. It's a... I know. It is, you know, I have to say, every single time I say that, somebody laughs. And it's just how it is. There's something kind of funny about it. And last time I was here, I was sharing some stories about what goes on in the laundromat that are connected to the Dharma. And one of the things is that has to do with the laundry bags. And I'm not going to go into the whole story of it now. And I brought one with me last week, and Janelle?
Denise.
Denise got it, and somebody said, next time you come, bring more. So there are some left. They've already, some disappeared. So help yourself to a laundry bag. They're for you. They're really great for camping. They're good for laundry. They're good for all kinds of things. So they're back there. Yes?
I was going to buy a laundry bag today.
You were?
I have a little friend going to summer camp, and it says bring a laundry bag.
Perfect.
I was going to buy her a laundry bag today. And I...
There you go. It's your Dharma Door prize. I'm so glad that... Tell me your name.
Shelley.
Shelley, great. Enjoy. Okay, here's where I want to start. Oh, karma, dharma, pudding, and pie, give me a break before I die. Grant me wisdom, will, and wit, purity, probity, pluck, and grit. Trustworthy, loyal, helpful, kind, give me great abs and a steel trap mind. And forgive ye gods some humble advice, these little blessings would suffice to beget an earthly paradise. Make the bad people good and the good people nice. And before our world goes over the brink, teach the believers how to think. Isn't that great? One more time, and then we'll talk a little bit. Oh, karma, dharma, pudding and pie, give me a break before I die. Grant me wisdom, will, and wit, purity, probity, pluck, and grit. Trustworthy, loyal, helpful, kind, give me great abs and a steel trap mind. And forgive ye gods some humble advice, these little blessings would suffice to beget an earthly paradise. Make the bad people good and the good people nice, and before our world goes over the brink, teach the believers how to think. So what's the great line? Teach the believers how to think. My mother sent me this poem a number of years ago, and she, like me, she loves poetry, and I probably got that from her, and so I've just had that sitting in my file. And this is an apropos time to be thinking about what do we believe? Who are we in our belief systems? Because all of us have them, and it's really important to think about what are our beliefs and how do they affect us. So I think that that line, teach the believers how to think, is what the Buddha was teaching us in the Kalama Sutta. So here's the sutta and see what you think. It is indeed fitting to be uncertain. It is fitting to doubt. For in situations of uncertainty, doubts surely arise. You should decide not by what you've heard, not by following convention, not by assuming it is so, not by relying on the texts, not because of reasoning, not because of logic, not by thinking about explanations, not by acquiescing to the views that you prefer, not because it appears likely, and certainly not out of respect for a teacher. When you would know for yourselves that these things, greed, ill will, and delusion, are unhealthy and inclined toward harm and suffering, then you should reject them. But when you know for yourselves that these things, non-greed, non-ill will, non-delusion, are healthy and inclined towards welfare and happiness, then you should stay with them. And I think he summarized it in his injunction, what, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? That's the question, right? So teach the believers how to think. How do we think? What's going on? We need to learn from our direct experience, and we hear this repeatedly, over and over again in the Dharma, over and over again in our practice. What is happening right now in our bodies, in our hearts, and in our minds? So as we settle into our meditation this morning, keep that in mind. What are you noticing in your direct experience? Letting things come and go. Suzuki Roshi has a great instruction around meditation that I think I may have heard from Tony Bernhard when he was here, that says, keep your front door and back door open and let the thoughts come and go. Just don't serve them tea. Isn't that great? So those are great meditation instructions, and we can use them in our daily lives also. But some thoughts we need to serve tea. We need to look at our beliefs. We need to see how they function. But for today, in our meditation, see if you can keep that breezeway going. And as we sit, I'll give you a little bit more guidance, but not much. Are there any questions before we start? Thank you for coming. We'll sit together. As we settle in to our bodies, our hearts, our minds, our breath, we become fully present. Widening the awareness to include all aspects of ourselves. Knowing, feeling, sensing what is here, allowing ourselves to drop out of our minds and into the body and into our senses. And as we come into this practice of becoming fully present, feel your heart. Drop in. You might start with a little gratitude for yourself for coming to practice today. A sense of arriving, like sitting with a good friend, sitting in practice with a good friend. Perhaps offering a little gratitude to those around you who've also come to practice. Feeling the heart. And as we settle into this presence and this awareness of the heart, being just here, right here, with just enough energy to stay alert and engaged, but not over-efforting, allowing yourself to engage the next moment without an agenda. Nothing to do. Nowhere to go. Resting right here. And as always, the mind will wander, and as soon as you notice that wandering, gently draw it back to the body, to the breath, to the heart. And begin again. It's helpful for you. You can even say to yourself, right here, begin again. in this very quiet, still place, allowing yourself to drop into the silence a little bit more. Let the silence drop into you a little bit more. Feeling your own presence, the presence of those around us, sensing the heart. If you have a regular metta practice, loving kindness practice, going through a few rounds of your own blessings or compassion practice, I'll give you some phrases. We'll just work with this for a few minutes. It's always good to practice compassion. Sensing the center of the chest, the heart center. May I accept myself just as I am right in this moment. May I surround my limitations with respect, care, and love. May I be supported with strength, steadiness, and courage. May I rest in the beauty and in the goodness of my awakening heart. And just as we wish compassion for ourselves, offer ourselves this care, we do the same for others. So this is a time we can bring into the room those we may be thinking about, who we care for, who we hold in our hearts. I'm thinking of my friend Mickey, a fellow Dharma practitioner who is struggling with chronic illness. And just this morning sent me a note saying, right now, it's like this. We send her love. Who are you thinking about? All those we hold in our hearts, we do offer care and love, strength, the wish for the ability to carry our joys and our sorrows as best as we can with the support of others. And as Thich Nhat Hanh instructs us, we sit for those who cannot sit. We walk for those who cannot walk. And we cultivate peace and stillness in our lives for those who have no peace or stillness. And sometimes that includes us. Let's take 5 minutes. We'll take a 5-minute break before we start. Good time to stretch, get a drink of water, take care of yourself. I'll ring the bell in a few minutes. If you came in a little bit after we started earlier and you're wondering why there are laundry bags on the back table, they are for you. And if there's one left, please don't hesitate to take the last one. I brought them because my other job is I have a laundromat in Arcata, and last time I was here, I told a funny story about laundry bags, and people said, bring more. So please take them. They're for you. I'm wondering if you noticed those meditation instructions, how you felt about them. So the instructions were from Pema Chodron. Be fully present, feel your heart, and engage the next moment without an agenda. That's the hard one, right? It's really hard. But actually, I was reading one of her books not long ago and came across that as there are basically three instructions for our sitting practice and for our daily life practice. And those are they. Be fully present. And that's huge, of course. It's a continual practice. Feel your heart. Really come into that awareness of what's happening, that capacity to feel what's happening, and that it's good to feel our hearts, to know what's in there, and to engage the next moment without agenda. That's equanimity, right? So we have mindfulness, be fully present, feel the heart, that's our loving kindness, compassion practice, and engaging the next moment without agenda. That's like Gil Fronsdahl, who says, let's see what happens next. It's not always easy to do that, is it? You know, let's just wait and see what happens next, or engage the next moment without an agenda. We all have an agenda. But this practice, at least for this period of time that we are sitting, can we take those instructions and just let them be our meditation instructions? And this is where we work the ground, where we work this muscle of awareness that lets us let the thoughts come and go and not serve them tea, just to really feel what's here. Did you notice those instructions, anybody? Yeah, kind of? Good. You might take those and practice with them. They're really, really lovely. So as I started working with that, I've been thinking a lot lately about what does it mean to practice? What is this practice doing for me, doing for us? How does it affect me? How does it affect us? This continual question that I think we come to about why am I doing this? Toward what end? And it's a great question that we work with continuously, and the answers to that change. I imagine you've found that the answers to that change over time as we work with why are we practicing and what are we learning? What does it mean to be engaged and committed to a practice that requires us to be fully present and to explore what that means? Or even to think of ourselves as practitioners. What does it mean to be a practitioner? How do we identify with our own practice? I like that. I don't know about you, but I actually really like that aspect of thinking of myself and having this commitment to practice that I am serious about. I really feel that I like that identification as a practitioner. So I recently came across this piece on the website On Being. Are you familiar with On Being, Krista Tippett? Do you know her? Krista Tippett is a wonderful writer, thinker, interviewer of very interesting people. And she has a website, a blog, a radio site called On Being. You can look it up. And she does work in civil conversations, talking to people about how are we having civil conversations. She does it through story, through poetry. And she's very interested in the intersection of contemplative practice, art and science. And so the interviews, she interviews some really interesting people. I really enjoy reading her work and listening to it. She's a great interviewer. So recently on the site, she had a piece from a woman named Christine Walters-Paintner, who is a Benedictine. I believe she is in Ireland, and she's the abbess of an online monastery called the Abbey of the Arts. And she's come up with something called the Monk Manifesto. Isn't that great? The Monk Manifesto. So, you know, we are not, probably most of us are not ordained monastics, but we are lay practitioners. And so in the spirit of thinking about what does it mean to be a practitioner, here are the seven commitments that she and people in her community have put together. And I think across wisdom traditions of all kinds, you will recognize this. I think that similar to our precepts of non-harming, you'll see these parallels. So here they are. I want to talk about them a little bit. The first one: I commit to finding moments each day for silence and solitude, to make space for another voice to be heard, and to resist a culture of noise and constant stimulation. Second one: I commit to radical acts of hospitality by welcoming the stranger both without and within. I recognize that when I make space inside my heart for the unclaimed parts of myself, I cultivate compassion and the ability to accept those places in others. I commit to cultivating community by finding kindred spirits along the path, soul friends with whom I can share my deepest longings, and mentors who can offer guidance and wisdom for the journey. I commit to cultivating awareness of my kinship with creation and a healthy asceticism by discerning my use of energy and things, letting go of what does not help nature to flourish. I commit to bringing myself fully present to the work I do, whether paid or unpaid, holding a heart of gratitude for the ability to express my gifts in the world in meaningful ways. I commit to rhythms of rest and renewal through the regular practice of Sabbath, and resist a culture of busyness that measures my worth by what I do. I commit to a lifetime of ongoing transformation, recognizing that I'm always on a journey with both gifts and limitations. What do you think? What stood out for you in those? I know you don't have the written list, but just from what you heard, is any of that particularly striking?
I like that we're always on a journey.
Yeah. Yeah, we are.
Be cautious of being defined
by what we do. Yeah. So then that comes to, I define myself as a practitioner. So what does that mean for being cautious by, you know, defining? I thought about that, you know, as I think about that. But I think it's a reflection point to think about that. Anybody else? Yeah. Yeah. That idea of being aware of how we are busy and stimulated all the time. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else? One more. Yeah, Marty.
Welcoming all parts of myself.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
Welcoming all parts of ourselves. You know, had a moment on a retreat up the hill a few years ago. I think Larry was teaching, Larry Yang, and oftentimes, you know, in the beginning of a retreat, in the welcome and orientation, if you've been on retreat, there is an orientation to how the retreat is going to go. And I remember when he said, Every part of you is welcome here. No part left out. That really went in me the first time I heard that. And I thought, if that's what this place is teaching, if that's what this practice is about, I'm in. All in. No part left out. So I want to talk about that specifically today. I want to take on... We'll talk about the second one. And I'm going to pause because I want to remember before we end today that Anne has an announcement that we were going to make before we started, and I'm really sorry that I forgot. So please help me remember before we end. Thank you. All right. Let's come back. I really didn't want to forget about that. So here's what I want to talk about in our practice today. I commit to radical acts of hospitality by welcoming the stranger both without and within. I recognize that when I make space inside my heart for the unclaimed parts of myself, I cultivate compassion and the ability to accept those places in others. Radical acts of hospitality. So I know Sylvia has been talking about radical integrity. She and Grace Fisher did a day long a couple weeks ago, and Grace will be here next week. This idea of radical acts. It's a radical act for us to come and sit and be quiet with ourselves. This idea of radical, what is radical? The root, the Latin root of it is the root, thoroughly and completely. So radical acts of hospitality, to be fully present, to feel our hearts, and to be willing to engage the next moment without an agenda, to actually say, all right, it's like this. What is happening here? I will bring my best self to this. I might bring my limited self. I'm going to bring myself as I am. So let's take this apart. The first sentence, I commit to radical acts of hospitality by welcoming the stranger both without and within. So what are those aspects of ourselves that we don't recognize? We all have them. Aspects of others, those we love. Do you ever have you ever had the experience of perhaps being in a long relationship with somebody, whether it's a partner or a dear friend or a family member, and some aspect of them, something happens and an aspect of them comes out, and you think, I never knew that about this person. I've never seen that part. Or we say something that surprises us about ourselves. Oh, I didn't know I felt that. I didn't know I thought about that. And to be open, to have the spaciousness to include all of that, or just the possibility for aspects of ourselves to surface. I think that's what our sitting practice prepares us to do. No part left out. So who is the stranger? And can we become, get to know these parts? Pema also says, we come to know ourselves with immense kindness and honesty. I love that. I want to feel immensely kind and immensely honest, but to have some care around how we feel that honesty. We want to be careful in our, what we think of as truth-telling, certainly to others. And this is how we come back to teach the believers how to think. You know, what is it that we think is true? This is a poem about how to become present, how to feel our heart, how to be in exactly what we are in. This poem is from Hogan Bays. He is Roshi at the Great Zen, the Great Vow Monastery. It's a Zen monastery in Oregon. His wife is Jan Chosen Bays. They're both the Zen priests of the monastery. And this is his poem. In this passing moment, karma ripens and all things come to be. I vow to choose what is. If there is cost, I choose to pay. If there is need, I choose to give. If there is pain, I choose to feel. If there is sorrow, I choose grief. When burning, I choose heat. When calm, I choose peace. When starving, I choose hunger. When happy, I choose joy. Whom I encounter, I choose to meet. What I shoulder, I choose to bear. When it is my death, I choose to die. Where this takes me, I choose to go. Being with what is, I respond to what is. This life is as real as a dream. The one who knows it cannot be found. And truth is not a thing. Therefore, I vow to choose this Dharma entrance gate. May all Buddhas and wise ones help me live this vow. Being with what is, I respond to what is. So how do we want to respond? What do you think? Anybody have an idea? Tickle his toes? I just think we let well enough be. Yeah. You can do that if you like. If somebody would like to gently go over, we can do that, or we can just let him rest. I think it's fine. What do you think of that poem? What strikes you? There are copies in the back if you don't have one. Deep acceptance, yeah, that is what it's about, isn't it? I think that's right. I think that's right.
Is it passivity
or... Yeah, that is the heart of it right there. So the question is it passivity or do we do something? How do we do this? I don't think that what our practice says is whatever's happening, it's just what's happening. I think that where we're going with this is we are going to connect this being with what is, I respond to what is as a radical act of hospitality, saying, okay, it's like this, and now we're going to connect this directly to the aspect of the Eightfold Path, which is wise effort. So wise effort is this ability to know what's happening and to respond appropriately. So we don't let harm continue to be done, even internal harm. We notice the ways in which we cause harm for ourselves. We say, wait a minute, is this supporting me? And this goes all the way back to the Buddha's injunction of what, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness. So being with what is, we're recognizing it, and we take appropriate action. Does that help? Okay, good. So wise effort. I think that that's what this is pointing to. Wise effort is such a meaty, important part of the Eightfold Path and of our practice. And this is where we come back to the Kalama Sutta from the beginning. It's find out for yourself through your direct experiencing what supports you and what does not. Enhance what supports you and try to let go of what does not. So that's what this poem is teaching us. When calm, I choose peace. Know what peace feels like. Pause, take this in. When starving, I choose hunger. Oh, this is what hunger feels like. We are so quick to remedy anything in us, to make changes in anything in us that we find the slightest bit uncomfortable. So our practice is continually helping us to turn towards this discomfort and learn how to manage it. So watching the mind, getting to know what our habits and tendencies are, Is it supportive? Is it unsupportive? And it takes a lot of effort and energy and diligence and persistence and patience to skillfully respond to the flow of experience. It's like we're in this river and we're learning to paddle and we have to read the water. And some things we can anticipate and some things we can't. But in choppy water, we proceed in a certain way, and in smooth water, we're more at ease. You know this quote that Jack brings in from Annie Lamott fairly regularly that says something to the effect of, "My mind isn't a safe neighborhood. I don't like to go there alone." So wise effort holds our hand. This accompanies us. This accompanies us so we can say, all right, you know, there's a lot of unpleasantness going on in my mind today. How do I want to be with this? And having some confidence that we can do this. So I was reading a little bit of the Dalai Lama recently. There's a new book out for, maybe it's not so new, but he and Archbishop Desmond Tutu spent a week together celebrating their 80th birthdays last year or the year before. And the book is called The Book of Joy, and it is a collection of their conversations over a week. And it's just a delightful book. I imagine it's in the bookstore. It's really worth taking a look at it. But he was talking about wise effort, this aspect of the path. Now, just as a brief overview, there are four parts to wise effort. They're called the four great endeavors. The first one is to prevent difficult mind states from arising. We all have latent tendencies for certain difficult mind states, whether it's a propensity towards anxiety or worry or fear or anger or frustration. We just have these natural tendencies. And the Dalai Lama likened this to how we take care of our physical bodies. So we tend to also have latent ailments that come up, physical ailments. Maybe we have arthritis, maybe we have digestive issues, maybe we get headaches. So we limit our exposure to the conditions that bring these things about. Same thing with the mind. If we know that, for me, going to scary movies creates bad dreams, creates a lot of anxiety, I don't go to scary movies. So that's how I can prevent my latent tendency towards fear of, I don't know, fear of horror, fear of scary stuff from arising. I don't expose myself to that because I don't have a good filter for that. So just like with the body, we don't expose ourselves to things that trigger our latent physical tendencies. But when we do get sick, or I do get scared because I watched the wrong thing or read the wrong thing, then we know how to address it. So we have remedies. So we get sick, sometimes we take antibiotics, or we do whatever we do to remedy that illness. Or when I am afraid, what are the things that I do in that moment to soothe myself? You know, that great teaching from Sylvia? Sweetheart, you're in pain. Take a breath. Now take another one. It'll pass. We do these kinds of things to recognize, oh, this is what fear feels like. My hands get clammy. My heart beats a little bit faster. All right, go outside. Go for a walk. You'll feel better. So that's what we do when these difficult mind states have arisen. We recognize them, and we do what we know is skillful for us to let them go. And then, also, like the body, when we know we're just fine and we're healthy, we do things to maintain it. We know what those things are, getting enough rest and eating well. We have this place where we're just fine. Nothing's really wrong. Same thing with the mind. When the mind is at ease and we are in this place of, you know, I'm really okay. When I feel calm, when I am calm, I feel peace, what this poem says. We notice it. We need to take it in. This is really important, that when things are okay, we don't need to look for trouble. You know, we have a way of stirring our own pot, where we don't need to fix what isn't broken. We don't need to rethink everything in our lives when things are just kind of at ease. Or maybe we think it's a little boring because there's no drama. Take that in. No drama is great. It's really good for our nervous systems to know what that feels like. And then when we're feeling well, again, back to what the Dalai Lama says about the body, we do things to enhance it. So, you know, when we have the strength and the awareness to say, huh, you know, when I eat certain foods, I feel really good. Eat those foods. When I know that I want to get outside for an hour every day, I'm healthier, I feel better. Whatever it is that is the thing that you know that supports you, it's not just our bodies, but it's our minds that we want to do this with. So what the Dalai Lama said about this is that just in the same way that we care for our physical beings, wise effort cares for our mind, and what he called it is mental immunity. Sort of an interesting term, isn't it? Because we are keeping our bodies healthy. We have some amount of immunity that comes and goes. We get sick. We go through these repeated cycles of good health and ill health. Same thing in our minds, right? We go through these cycles of difficult mind states and healthy mind states. Catch our reactivity, right? This is where the reactivity happens. So we get triggered. We see that we got triggered by the same thing again because it's the kind of thing that triggers us. Don't feed it. Don't bite the hook. And that takes some skill. Try not to feed the storyline. This is the story of Mara, right? From the, you know, the story of Mara, the night of the Buddha's enlightenment, when he sat under the Bo tree. And Mara, the trickster, Mara, the one who continually shows up in the Buddha's life to say, why do you think you can become enlightened? What's so great about you? No, 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 you don't get to do this. And so the story goes that he brings about what are called all of the armies of Mara to try to dissuade the Buddha from taking his rightful place to become awakened. And every time another distraction, whether it's his beautiful daughters or weapons or, you know, all these different things that came to distract the Buddha, and the Buddha was able to say, Mara, I see you. And every time he says, Mara, I see you, the things that were there, the weapons, the distractions dissolve. So we can do this. We see these things that can come up for us, and they are our own personal Mara. And we can say, yeah, I see you. Not this time. I'm not going to go there. And just try it out. Just try it out sometime to not bite the hook and see how that feels. It may take a lot of discipline to not react, to not shoot that other arrow, to not say, yeah, but. We all know that, right? It is really hard to not say, yeah, but. Or the way we get so, we're so loyal to our opinions, our self-righteous indignation. We have that. But to just take a breath right in that moment and say, I'm just going to wait. Maybe I don't have to have an agenda on this one right now. So that's the first one. See it and don't feed it. That is preventing these difficult mind states from arising and taking hold. Yes, please.
So it kind of, I heard the word passivity, but really I was reading another book.
Yes.
The action.
Shifting from the thinking aspect of the mind to the awareness aspect of the mind. That's right. So that is the action we take, is to settle back a little bit, to notice the story, notice the thinking, and say, huh, is this actually true? Do I really want to go down this route? And to shift back into awareness. So what is it that we're becoming aware of in that moment? The body? What's happening in the body? If we send some energy into the body right in that moment of reactivity, it helps us ground. It helps the central nervous system balance a bit. We come to the heart. What am I feeling? Ah, fear. What do I really want to fear? Feel. Care. Ah, I care about this. Take a breath. So yes, the thinking is what can take us down that road. So then the next one is, when we are caught and we realize we're in it, how do we release these difficult mind states? And that, I think, is where we're coming into the heart of the matter. Because we do get caught. Of course we get caught. This is about how do we live our human life. And the Buddha uses language like abandon unwholesome arisen states. So let go of what doesn't feed you. Let go of what doesn't support you. Easier said than done, right? This is not so simple. How do we have to recognize it first, that we're actually in this difficult state, so we can just try to let go of the death grip a little bit, move into the awareness aspect instead of being caught deeply in that thinking aspect. And then we start to disentangle. We start to see how it affects us, and we start to bit by bit disentangle from the ways in which we're caught. So, you know, we're living through difficult times in our country, and we're all getting caught over and over again. Can we come back to the truth of impermanence and say, all right, right now it's like this, and it's not going to be like this indefinitely. This is not permanent. For me, that's very helpful in difficult times, to recognize that it's not permanent. And to find ways over and over again to say, all right, it's like this right now. How can I best be with this? When we have difficult, unkind thoughts, can we even meet those gently? And to recognize, difficult, unkind, maybe mean thoughts. All right, let that go. Got that out. That was there. Let that go. This is doing the work. Managing our difficult mind states really is the heart of the practice. We turn towards our lives. We turn towards this. And this is, somebody said it earlier, profound acceptance. This is an acceptance of how things are. And I like to think of it also as a surrendering. Not surrendering, I give up, raise the white flag. I don't mean that at all. When we really surrender and really come into that place of, okay, it's like this, then we can deal with it. Because then there's no more denial. We're not going to wake up tomorrow and have it be a different situation. We're probably going to wake up tomorrow and have it be a similar situation, and we still need to deal with it. Whether it's teaching the believers how to think, whether, you know, if we're talking about political situations, or we have loved ones, people who are dear to us, who may be in the end of their lives, and it's painful. Or we have people who aren't at the end of our lives, of their lives, that are going through tremendously difficult times, or even ourselves. When we can shift from needing to fix or change to saying, all right now, this is really how it is, then we can move to work with it. Are you with me on this? That's radical hospitality. I commit to radical acts of hospitality. I am going to include this too. And I think it's also the third noble truth. We know the first truth is that in life there is suffering and struggle. The second is that the struggle comes from our insistence that things be other than how they are. But the third one, peace is possible. There's an end to suffering. There's this end to suffering right in this moment when I surrender to how things are. I think that's the third noble truth. This is how it is. There's a fantastic book written by Father Gregory Boyle called Tattoos on the Heart. Anybody heard of it? You know, but it's really beautiful. It's probably in the bookstore. And Father Boyle started something called Homeboy Industries in Los Angeles for, it started out with boys and then girls of people afflicted living in gangs. And the work that he has done to transform lives, people who are living in gang violence across the generations, in and out of jail, it's absolutely heart-stopping to read what he's done. But part of what he has done is adopted a practice of what he calls no matter whatness. You can't disappoint us enough, is what he would say to his boys, to his kids. Imagine somebody saying that, you can't possibly disappoint me enough. I will love you no matter what. That's an amazing thing to say. Even the people who are causing the most harm, committing horrendous crimes. And he includes them and says, you're going to go to jail, but when you're in jail, I'm going to teach you how to get out. And we're going to teach you how to live a life. So I think that that's what we're talking about in this second aspect of wise effort, when we are really looking at how do we let go of these difficult things that are happening in our minds, this radical hospitality, surrendering and accepting, okay, things are tough, I'm going to work with it. And then we gather in our resources to do that. So back to the poem, being with what is, I respond to what is. That's the injunction. That's the work. And, you know, in our practice itself, when these difficult states come up, we treat them with the antidotes of loving kindness, metta practice, and compassion practice, equanimity practice, because it's a beautiful practice that supports our hearts. In this moment, may I be at ease. May I surround my limitations with love, recognizing that we all have limitations. We are not super beings. And as we investigate, we can do some investigation in our practice too with these difficult states, asking ourselves questions like, is this actually true? Do I need to believe everything I think? Probably not. Right? You know that bumper sticker, don't believe everything you think. It's great. It's really it's great Dharma, piece of Dharma. And then we have some hope and trust and faith. Because we, if we're in this practice and we're working it, we know that it supports us. That's why we show up here. We show up to practice for ourselves and we show up to practice with each other. I like to thank God for impermanence. It's true, you know, things will change. Things really will change. They might not change for the better, but they're going to change, and ultimately we'll have our ups and downs. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, he says, to choose hope is to step firmly forward into the howling wind, bearing one's chest to the elements, knowing that in time the storm will pass. I just choose to believe him. I think that that's just true. I think it feels really nice to do that, just to know it's a storm, we can move into it. We have each other, whether literally in the room or virtually, we know we have a great big sangha in this practice, and we can move forward in it. So then moving to the third of these great efforts is cultivating and nurturing a wholesome mind. When we really know things are okay, to take that in, to feel it, to greet it, to greet our own wholesome mind and enjoy it. Wow, nice to see you today. This feels good. I'm just going to be in this. And then to seed it. What can we do to support it? So we know when the mind is at ease. This is when we're over the hump in these great efforts. We got through the difficult part for the moment. So we know when the mind is at ease. Mindfulness of the mind. This is important. This is a huge practice, right? A mind full of ease is like this. A busy mind is like this. A distracted mind is like this. An easeful mind, a joyful mind, a quiet mind is like this. Noticing how that feels in the body, in the heart, in our lives. What happens in our relationships, in our interactions when we are at ease. It changes everything, doesn't it? Really is helpful. So then we seed it. We greet this beautiful mind, and then we seed it so it can grow and actually strengthen in its roots. And we do that with our meditation practice. Our meditation practice is so important. That is where we are developing this muscle of awareness. Everything comes up in meditation. We know that. But it also supports us, and we stick with it. And we continue to seed it also with our practices of loving kindness and compassion. This is really important. Include that. I hope you include that in your practice of awareness. Every time you sit, if you can either begin or end with some practice of loving kindness and compassion, it will really support your heart and really support your own capacity to feel that wherever you are. It really does, it really takes over. We keep working it and working it. So we can ask ourselves, you know what, when we come back to this question of why am I doing this, towards what end, what is coming out of this? We are cultivating this way of being in our lives that is incredibly wholesome and effective, and it makes changes all around us. One of Suzuki Roshi's students came to him at some point in his own training and said to Suzuki Roshi, "What is the most important thing?" And Suzuki Roshi said, "To find out what is the most important thing." I love that. This is a continual process. This isn't going to end. All right, and then the fourth of the great efforts is to be able to enhance these wholesome states of mind, to enhance the ability to come into radical acts of hospitality in ourselves. And so this is where we really want to notice, for instance, a generous thought arises. Do something about that. You know, the inclination to be generous, act on your generous inclinations. That helps enhance these mind states and really grow them. Do that. This practice of noticing the good. Notice the good. We don't have to look too far. This is not making a project out of it. We don't have to make a project or manufacture a feeling. just look around and you can notice good. When you notice good, take it in. Be fully present. Feel your heart. And it will change the brain. It changes what we notice. It changes our capacity. So this is what we do. We really notice the good. We give ourselves encouragement to keep going in this practice. This is good. It supports us. Keep doing it. And then it tends to have some momentum. It builds on itself. So those are these great four efforts. Prevention, recognition of difficult states and release, maintaining and enhancing. And I think that what comes out of all of that is when we get to the second line of this injunction of I commit to radical acts of hospitality, is I recognize that when I make space inside my heart for the unclaimed parts of myself, I cultivate compassion and the ability to accept those places in others. That's really what's going on here, isn't it? The more we make friends with ourselves, the more we do that naturally with each other. It's just what happens. It's just what happens. So wise effort, radical acts of hospitality. It's a continual process. It's a continual practice. It requires so much patience and steadiness and persistence because it's not easy. It sounds simple, but we know it's not easy. And when we bring a spirit of generosity to ourselves, recognizing every single time we sit down with ourselves in this practice is an act of generosity towards our own minds, our own hearts, it supports us and it helps us manage our fundamental humanity, being in our lives. It supports our wisdom, it supports our compassion, it supports our ability to know the difference between harming and non-harming and how all that whole piece, it supports us in living a life that is really rooted in non-harming. And from the Dhammapada, from the Buddha, it says, engaged in the Buddha's teachings, even a young practitioner lights up this world like the moon set free from a cloud. That's what we're doing. Engaged in the Buddha's teachings, even a young practitioner lights up this world like a moon set free from a cloud. So let's talk with each other. Let's end there. What are you thinking about? Will you say your name?
Yes, my name is Andrew.
Andrew, thank you.
Bill.
Yes, it is.
So I wrote this down as you were talking throughout the hour, because this has been sitting with me about what is exactly mindfulness meditation. So this is what I wrote with feeding off what you were saying. Mindfulness meditation trains our minds to notice the brain and body's reactive nature so that we can respond with skillful compassion for ourselves and others.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think it's perfect.
Is it? Okay.
So you teach mindfulness, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like that you're still, that you're working that definition, because I work that definition too all the time, all the time. And we have to revisit that. So mindfulness meditation, will you read that again for us?
Mindfulness meditation trains our minds to notice the brain and body's reactive nature or reactivity so that we can respond with skillful compassion for ourselves and others.
Yeah, I think that that's right. It is training the brain and the mind. As we train the brain, it changes the mind. As we train the mind, it changes the brain. There's that whole part in there too. But the point is so we can respond skillfully with kindness and compassion. And this is a forever training. Does anybody have anything else to how would you change that definition at all? Or add to it? Wouldn't it be interesting to have a big board and say, mindfulness meditation is, and see what comes up on that? I think that would be fascinating. Thank you. Thanks, Andrew. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah. Can you say your name, please? Thank you.
My name is Susan.
Thank you, Susan.
And I lost my brother just a month ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. But this poem, I want to kind of have it tattooed on my chest right now because it's exactly how I feel.
Yeah.
And, you know, when burning, I choose heat. If there is sorrow, I choose to grieve. And also when happy, I choose joy. I notice the moments when I'm happy, and they're such treasures right now. When it is my death, I choose to die. Where this takes me, I choose to go. This is the most sort of comforting and reflective piece of writing that I could possibly imagine. And I've been reading a lot and writing a lot.
Yeah.
And just that, you know, being in this incredibly deep feeling place, it's okay, you know. My dear friends, you know, check in with me, how are you doing today? And some days I'm not doing well at all, and some days I'm doing okay. And I'm really grateful for my practice because I don't think if I weren't meditating every day and hadn't been for quite a while that I would be as okay as I am.
That's a testament.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Thank
about
you.
Your brother.
Thank
and,
you.
You know, I think that probably the biggest gift of our practice is that it asks us and invites us into feel exactly what we feel right in this moment. And we don't have to change it. We don't have to fix it. We don't have to push it away. And so, yeah, that's, I think that this piece of Dharma is so important, and it lets us surrender into exactly what it is. And we don't have to explain it away. We don't have to analyze it. It's just what it is. And I love that your friends say, how are you today? I think that's an important piece when we're grieving. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So first I just want to kind of thank you for the space today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So I'm going through... Oh, sorry. I'm going through a lot of types of change right now. And I guess I'm wanting to speak to the fact that I read things like this and they resonate and they seem like, yeah, like that's it. And then I guess I just want to speak to the like cellular level of agitation when we are trying to shift away from doing to being or like trying to embody. like what's on the paper, and what it means. Like, I guess that maybe that's part of like the, you know, kind of choosing heat or choose like just choose to like be in that agitation, and how much, I don't know, again, I say cellular, like it's like a core body being resistance to that that can come up.
Yeah, and it's uncomfortable.
Perfectly at times. And I think even like I also teach mindfulness and how as it relates to behavior change and lots of other things. And I think that I can, the difference between, you know, teaching and practicing and just and what it means to really sit with that core agitation when it arises and still be in the practice and trust in that's actually where you're supposed to be. Which is really,
because it's so hard to sit with cellular core agitation.
Yeah.
Because that's not what our culture conditions us to do. Mm-hmm. If it's uncomfortable, change it. Mm-hmm. God forbid we should be uncomfortable and get to know what that is.
Yeah.
So this practice, we can shy away, but our practice says, yep, it's hot. Mm-hmm. In the heat, it's hot. But we also need to know when to apply the energy and when to back off. So that's also really important to know the gas pedal on this one.
Yeah, the compassion part around not doing it right, like that, that being like super on practitioner is the only way through, kind of like that, like knowing when to have ease of being.
Yeah. I mean, what's right anyway?
Yeah.
Right? What's perfection anyway? That is some external construct that, again, from our cultural conditioning, that I think does incredible damage to us when we have this idea of doing it right or perfection, that we can't achieve that. But that ability to hang out with what is on a cellular level, that agitation, I think that it's important to touch into that gently and then back out. Mm-hmm. Go into it, feel it, notice how it is. You don't have to analyze it. Come back out and breathe, and some compassion practice.
It's been really awesome for my partner, too.
Yeah.
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 Saying, like, trying to hold that
right
while I'm going through it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard work. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Carol. I had a rough 5 years with like some chronic illness with Lyme disease and chronic fatigue, and happily I'm on the other side of it. What I notice is that it's not necessarily like I feel like I'm in the restorative phase, mm-hmm. but the intense agitation is gone, but there's like these lingering fears and around trusting my body and feeling safe in my body and how I distance myself from people because I was just so physically uncomfortable that I had to retreat. So like reentry is very challenging to kind of reconnect and to trust. So I find that it's often with these like stages that they're kind of messy.
They are messy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That you can get past something and you're still carrying pieces of it with you.
I don't think healing is linear. In my experience around whether it is, whatever it is, whether it's trauma, whether it's physical illness, whether it's emotional challenge, it's not linear. And I also, I wonder what you think about this, but I think that this idea that we get over something is incorrect. I think that all of our experiences are in us, in our bodies, in our hearts, in our minds. They become our fabric. And when we can include all of our experiences, what we were talking about earlier, no part left out. The image that I have of this is of a cloth that is woven with many different kinds of fibers. And the Lyme's disease is one fiber, right? The fatigue is another fiber. The isolation is another. And the joy is another. The ease, the relief of feeling better. And sometimes they get pulled. These little threads get pulled and we get re-triggered and we say, oh, right, it's this one. It's the fear of getting sick again. It's the fear of this. Or, huh, I feel really good today. This is great. This is what's here today. This is the wise effort of recognizing what's here and how to manage it. So I think we can take the pressure off of ourselves when we, for me, the way I think about it is I don't have to get over it. I'm integrating. It's all aspects of myself. And our practice allows us to integrate all of these different aspects of ourselves. It's just part of who we are. And then it's not a project. We don't have to make our practice a project. And we can let our practice support us in this way. Is that helpful, Carol? Yeah. We have to end there. I'd like us just to sit quietly for a minute. As you go through your weeks, letting this practice resonate in you in ways that feels right for you, taking with you what resonates and leaving the rest behind. Trusting your own practice. Noticing the ways it supports you. May everyone everywhere have ease of heart, shelter, clothing, food, and good friends. Thank you for being here, for your very lovely, kind attention.